women workers for the company had accused the firm of paying women less than men. BBC News.
In the light of the Arab Spring, Edward Sturton meets the Foreign Secretary William Hague to explore the map of the new Middle East, as seen from London, Washington and Brussels. That's for analysis in 30 minutes. First on BBC Radio 4, Dr. Giles Fraser, the Canon Chancellor of St Paul's Cathedral, continues his history of the uneasy relationship between the church and money, the root of all evil.
Some years ago, I sat drinking coffee in Notting Hill Market and changed my mind. At university, I was a member of the Socialist Worker Party, believing that capitalism was one of the greatest evils ever visited upon mankind. And even when my politics softened, I retained a deep distrust of the market, a distrust that was widespread in the church into which I was ordained. But out here, amidst all the buzz of market trade, I saw something different. Here was energy and vitality, a real ethnic and social diversity. Suddenly, I got how capitalism had the ability to bring people together, how people who trade with each other generally don't make war with each other. In that moment, I made my peace with the market. In these programmes, I'm investigating the tension between the church and money, which has been there ever since Jesus advised his followers to give the whole lot up and follow him.
The problem with the church and with the bishops is they are very keen to discuss how the cake should be cut, but they pay, in my judgment, very little attention to how the cake is made. And if only they devoted more attention to how the cake is made, then I don't think you would have this apparent bias of the church against a market economy.
Financial markets without morality are far more dangerous than casinos. And that's, I think, the message that the church failed to convey.
If people are earning millions of pounds, well, OK. I think what would be really important is learning how to give it away. And, you know, tithing. Hey, come on, don't let's talk about tithing. Let's talk about 25%. Let's talk about 50%. That's an appropriate level if you earn that sort of money, to give at least 50% away.
The question of money has never been a simple one for the church. Last week, I looked at the conflict between the enormous wealth of the medieval Catholic Church and Jesus' teaching about giving it all away. Even those friars who tried to do without money inevitably found themselves sucked back into the practical realities of supporting themselves and sustaining an organisation. Caught between these powerful contrasts, the church wasn't best placed to make sense of the marketplace as it developed into early capitalism. But all of this was to change dramatically in the course of the Reformation. At the heart of the problem was the church's long-standing condemnation of usury, the lending of money at interest. It was this prohibition that blocked the development of international trade and had the terrible side effect of forcing Jews into the unpopular business of money lending, thus fueling centuries of anti-Semitism. I went to see Rabbi Laura Jenna Klausner at Aleph Synagogue in North London to find out where it all started.
So here we are at Aleph Synagogue, and I'm going to take out one of the scrolls, the handwritten scrolls, that we keep in a lovely big ark. You can hear the huge doors opening up. We put a crown or bells on top of our scrolls because for us this is the monarch, this is the queen or the king, rather than a person.
We're looking for the passage in Deuteronomy.
That's right.
That has the prohibition against lending money interest in it. Are we nearly there?
Yeah, we're nearly there. Okay. So you will hear scrolling. So it's here.
Lo tashich la'achicha neshech kesef.
You shall not deduct interest from loans to your countrymen, whether in money or food or anything else that can be deducted as interest. But you may deduct interest from loans to foreigners.
Explain to me why it is that you can charge interest to foreigners, but Jews can't charge interest when loans to other Jews.
So interest and loaning things is in the field of tzedakah. Tzedakah comes from the word righteousness. You have to. It's obligatory charity. So if another person comes to me with whom I live in the village and says, I need money for seed or seed money or garments, you have to give it to them. So you loan it to them without an interest. And that is your forced, as it were, charity. But someone who comes from outside the village, someone who literally is a foreigner or someone who you don't know and you don't have surety that you will get a return on your loan, then you can charge interest because the risk is so much higher. So we're not talking about a anti-Gentile legislation. This is something to protect village people primarily against losing key elements of their sustenance.
And of course, the really horrible thing about how that was used in the Middle Ages was that Christians who became obsessed at some point in not lending money at interest managed to get the Jews to do it for them and then blame them for doing it.
Yes, it's a wonderful catch-22, because if I couldn't become, as a Jew, part of any guild, I couldn't have an apprenticeship, I couldn't become a blacksmith, a silversmith, I don't know what, but then I'm also so restricted in what I can do, about the only thing I can do is lend money, which is a humiliating and much hated profession for anybody. So if you're going to force me into that corner and then say, but I hate you for that corner, that's an excellent way of attacking a minority.
Exactly right.
Yeah. It's a bit odd, isn't it, that usury, which started as a Jewish prohibition, in the end makes Jews the object of Christian hatred.
Dermot McCulloch is Professor of the History of the Church at the University of Oxford.
And it's exactly the same sort of rhetoric is used towards Jews as has been used towards bankers in this country over the last few years. And so you build it up on the fact that these people could be also described as the killers of Christ. There's this awful Christian rhetoric from very early days. And so you can feel good about attacking moneylenders on sort of theological grounds, perverted theology. You have to say, actually, that the English record on the Jews is one of the worst. There are awful atrocities. For instance, in 1190, the Jewish population of York took refuge in the castle at York, and then they were burned alive. The castle was burned by the local population. And we have to remember that it was English society which was the first in Europe to expel all its Jews. And again, it was because of a cash-strapped king, Edward I, who thought that one very easy way of getting out of all his debts to the Jews would be to get rid of them. And so, more whipping up of anti-Semitic prejudice. And that was the end of the Jews of England in 1290.
Rabbi Laura, is there a hangover from that image of Jews as money lenders today?
Yes, definitely. The idea that Jews are mean is outrageous and atrocious. It's factually incorrect, and if you look at the philanthropy figures in Britain, Jews are amongst the highest givers of charity, voluntarily. It's a libel, and it is in the language. People talk about, you know, I'll Jew you. How disgusting is that?
And that's a hangover from this myth of the Middle Ages.
Yes, no question.
And of course, the most notorious representation of a Jewish moneylender is Shylock in Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. I went to see Patrick Stewart in rehearsal with the Royal Shakespeare Company.
How like a fawning publican he looks. I hate him. For he is a Christian, but more, for that in low simplicity he lends out money, gratis, and brings down the rate of usance here with us in Venice. If I can catch him once upon the hip, I will feed fat the ancient grudge I bear him. He hates our sacred nation, and he rails, even there where merchants most do congregate, on me, my bargains, and my well-won thrift, which he calls interest. Cursed be my tribe if I forgive him. One thing that often gets overlooked when the theological aspect of the play is discussed is that Shakespeare has written into this play, and particularly put into the mouth of Shylock, words which are there as an open indictment of Christian values. Shylock says, look, you as Christians do this, 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 and this. Shall we not be like you?
The world of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, of Shylock, is a world in which commerce is thriving in early modern Venice. A small, highly regulated Jewish community
is performing financial services that are not allowed to Christians.
Neil Ferguson is Professor of History at Harvard University and a visiting professor at the London School of Economics.
That is not to say that the only people who lent money in 16th century Europe were Jews. The Medici were not Jews. What the Medici did was to advance loans, but not formally to charge interest. There was an elaborate system of commissions and other forms of compensation that, in effect, paid the lender interest. But if you look at the Medici's accounts, you won't see interest rates anywhere. So lending went on, but it took different forms when it was Christian-to-Christian lending. What Charlotte could do was to lend explicitly at interest.
Protestant theologians struggled with these prohibitions against usury. Some said, leave it to the experts, we're not experts in economics. John Calvin said, let's think about a reasonable rate of interest. Was it 5%, 10%? They were clearly uncomfortable about it, but nonetheless, they had to recognise the reality of the society developing around them. The German sociologist Max Weber claimed that this change laid the foundations for capitalism itself.
I think Weber was half right, in the sense that something around about the time of the Reformation in the early 16th century kicked off in Western Europe that ultimately produced the capitalism we know and love, in other words, post-industrial capitalism. Weber thought that it was because Calvinism in particular made people behave in two distinct ways. One, it made them work hard for the sake of it, because work was a kind of proof of godliness. The second point is, it made you defer consumption, and therefore it made you save. So you were working away, running your business, not going on any shopping sprees or benders, so the money was piling up, and that was capital accumulation. That's really the essence of Weber's argument. I'm not sure it's entirely compelling for a whole range of reasons, of which the most obvious is that we see this behaviour on the part of non-Calvinists too. We see it on the part of Jews, for example, not to mention some Catholics. But what is true is that Protestantism promoted one particular human activity which was very capitalism-friendly, namely literacy. In other words, because Protestantism emphasises the reading of scripture in the vernacular, to be a successful Protestant society, you have to have quite high levels of literacy. It's not enough to have the priest mumbling away in Latin. Everywhere Protestantism spread, printing and literacy spread with it. And that certainly promoted the rise of capitalist society, because the more literate the population is, the more sophisticated the work they can do. So I've sort of varied in my recent work Weber's phrase from the Protestant work ethic to the Protestant word ethic, because there I think there is a meaningful causal connection.
Is the Reformation the sort of key linchpin here? Because, I mean, if you're trying to tell the sort of big story of Christianity with regard to money, to start with you have lots of seemingly very hostile things said about money in the scriptures, yeah, and stuff about usury and interest, yeah, and so forth, and Jesus and eyes of needles and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And then you get the monastic tradition, you get the Franciscans, you know, there's a story about St. Francis finding a monk holding a coin and he made it, put him in his mouth and shove it in a pile of dung. I mean, you're not even allowed to touch it. So you've got that deep tradition of hostility, suspicion of money. It's the root of all evil.
Yeah.
And then something changes and you get people like Weber saying, you know, this is what makes capitalism possible. So how did you go from one to the other? It seems extraordinary.
Max Weber's point was that the Reformation changes Christian faith and behaviour from an unworldly mode focused on the hereafter to a more worldly mode in which you leave the cloister, as Weber puts it, and you step into the marketplace.
So here I am back in the city of London, in the very heart of the financial world. And the church, of course, is a huge investor in the city of London. The church commissioners alone have an asset portfolio of nearly £5 billion. Indeed, it's estimated that some 6% of the world's investment capital is in the hands of religious bodies.
So what can the church say to all the bankers who work around here? I've come to the beautiful Art Deco Daily Express building on Fleet Street that's now the headquarters of Goldman Sachs International to talk theology with their vice chair, Lord Griffiths of Forest Vach. Lord Griffiths was the head of Mrs. Thatcher's policy unit and a director of the Bank of England, and he's a committed Christian. And I want to know how you get to square being a Christian with a role at the top of a big city bank. One of the stories in the Hebrew scriptures is Exodus and the story of manna from heaven.
Yeah.
And the idea that there is a sort of economy being described there in the desert, an economy which is, you know, you gather a certain amount for your needs, and there's a certain amount that's called enough. And if you gather too much, then it's useless and it'll... And Jesus seems to refer to that whole idea of enough and the lilies of the field and, just, you know, sufficient for the day and so forth. Now, the whole idea of enough, which has a sort of theological resonance throughout the scriptures, it's very interesting how Christians in the city might think about that whole idea of enough, where those of us who are outside are obviously sort of astonished by the sort of telephone number salaries that people get. Mm. How do those two things work together?
Well, first of all, in the passage in Exodus, which you relate to, you're talking really about an extreme situation where people needed manna. If you look at other parts of the Pentateuch, you know, it's, the promise is a land flowing with milk and honey. The world God created is just a fantastic world, and the bounty of the natural world is extraordinary. So, you know, almost the Irish joke, if I was looking at this, I wouldn't start with the manna. I would say the manna is really a very special case. But I do think you have a point, and St. Paul, it refers actually to the manna, and what he appeals to is the generosity of Christians. And to me, what I would derive from the manna, or better still, from Paul's interpretation of it in the New Testament, is that if we do have money, if we have wealth, then we have enormous responsibility in the way we use it. We are stewards of it, and we're stewards of it before God. So I don't think it's a question of how much you earn. It's really, to me, a question at a personal level of what you do with it.
I mean, Christianity can work perfectly well within a market economy.
Yes. I think, to me, the problem with the church and with the bishops is they are very keen to discuss how the cake should be cut, but they pay, in my judgment, very little attention to how the cake is made. And I think that is the fundamental point. And if only they devoted more attention to how the cake is made, the role of enterprise, the role of entrepreneurs, the role of markets and so on, and they had a better understanding of it, then I don't think you would have this apparent bias of the church against a market economy.
I mean, that resonates very strongly with that famous interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan of your former boss, Mrs. Thatcher, which is that, you know,
that's true.
You had to have the money in order to give it away.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You weren't behind that, were you?
No, but she was very strong in that. She used to tell me that every so often. She was very proud of how he kind of, you know, thought of it.
So you don't really think that the sort of Christian pressure comes on the sort of income side. It comes up what you do with it. So because there'll be a lot of people who would go, that sense of enough really... It feels some sort of moral...
Well,
that's part of the outrage that people out there feel about banks and cities, isn't it?
Well, I think part of the outrage is, and I feel it's justified. I mean, some banks became bust and had to be rescued by governments. And then they say, well, why should these people have earned so much? And why should they still be earning so much? And so on. I think when it comes to compensation in the city... If you have a market economy, you need to have a free market in the labour market as well as in the capital markets, in the product markets and so on. And if you look at the last 50 years, what you find is that differentials in every industry have just expanded enormously. You know, it's not just financial services. What interests me is that people who take their faith seriously, they actually do take their responsibilities of giving seriously. And I think that's very important.
So, has the church finally made its peace with money? There are no doubt many who will be persuaded by Lord Griffith's theology. But looking out from Goldman Sachs offices over the City of London, I couldn't help thinking about Brother Sam in Dorset. In last week's programme, I spoke to Brother Sam, a Franciscan friar, committed to a life of poverty taken directly from the Gospels. Franciscans are the conscience of the church. What would Sam say to bankers today? How much does he think is enough? And yes, what does he live on?
I have a budget of about, I think it's 3,000 a year. And that out of that comes all my fares. And when I use the car, it's the petrol. But that actually covers my only, buying a new pair of socks as well. And having a pint of beer on my way home. But at least two-thirds of it goes on transport. At least two-thirds, I would say.
Living like that, and reading in the newspapers about bonuses.
Yeah.
And when people earn millions and millions of pounds as a bonus.
I'm sort of mystified. I mean, it doesn't make me angry. I mean, it makes me angry that people can take it so much for granted. I mean, I think, and it mystifies me that people can take so little account of the poor. But it sort of mystifies me. What on earth would you find to spend all that money on? OK, and it's nice to go out to dinner sometimes, and it's nice to go to the theatre or to have a holiday, but my goodness, what on earth would you want to spend? What do you want to spend it all on?
But, so, I reckon I could spend it. Okay. I reckon I could have a jolly good go, and I'd enjoy having a go and so forth. So there'll be people who may listen and go, well, that's just a bit of a lack of imagination.
Well, perhaps it is. You know, a good bottle of wine, I suppose.
So what do I say in the city, ministering in the city, to those people who come to church, Christians, who earn millions of pounds?
Well, I think I can understand. I mean, in some ways, I do understand people who, bankers who say, well, actually, if we don't pay these sorts of salaries, we won't get the right people. But I would say if people are earning millions of pounds, well, OK, what would be really important is learning how to give it away. And, tithing, hey, come on, don't let's talk about tithing. Let's talk about 25%. Let's talk about 50%. That's an appropriate level if you earn that sort of money to give at least 50% away.
Well, they'll say they give more than that away already in tax.
Oh, come on, no, let's take it after tax then. Let's give away half your disposable income. How about that? And, of course, gift aid it as well, so you get the tax back on it. But, what the trouble is, I think, is that we live in a culture where we think we deserve this. This is our right.
Because I'm worth it.
Because I'm worth it. I mean, that is rubbish. The only way to live sanely is to live with a sense of gift. That, hey, isn't this great what I've got, what I've received? Therefore, let's acknowledge the sense of gift. Let's acknowledge that gift and give it away.
Well, I don't know if this makes me any less of a Christian, but the truth is, I'm really not prepared to give the whole lot away. So where does that leave Christians like me? The best thing I've ever heard on the subject of money was a sermon by Rowan Williams. He opposed the question, "For whom is your money good news?" And that has to be the church's challenge to the city as well. For whom is all of this money good news? When it comes to the City of London, I have to say, I'm still not entirely sure. Neil Ferguson thinks the problem is not just confined to Christianity, but that we're all in the same boat.
My sense is that regardless of whether you are an atheist, a Christian, a Jew, or for that matter, a Muslim, there is a fundamental problem about finance. And that is that if you enter into major financial transactions in an amoral spirit, without any sense of moral compass, the temptations to engage in fraud are very powerful indeed. Finance is all about asymmetric information. Generally speaking, one party knows a lot more than the other in a deal. Bankers know much more than the typical household when a mortgage is being negotiated. And I could go on in that vein. So that asymmetry of information, in fact, puts a significant moral burden on the more knowledgeable party in the transaction. If you are amoral, And there were certainly plenty of people besides Bernie Madoff who were amoral in the market. Then you can make a huge amount of money at the expense of more naive counterparties. That's why morality is terribly important in finance.
The reason I started making this programme in the first place, and this series of programmes, is that I got the impression that the church had had a really bad credit crunch, which is to say that we hadn't had anything, that we had something, we don't have anything to say.
Yeah.
And that, actually, if you look at the Bible, it's number one moral issue in the Bible, if you count up the references. It's not sex, it's money. Mm. And yet the church sort of went AWOL. So either it had people saying, like the Archbishop of York, saying they're all bank robbers, or it had very little to say, or just something sort of soft left and so forth. So, you're an atheist, so I shouldn't be looking to you for advice on this matter, perhaps. But do you have any idea why the church might have had such a bad credit crunch?
Part of the problem, it seems to me, for an established church, is that it was, of course, itself invested in the market. The people running the church were like the people running Harvard University. They had quite a lot of skin in the game, and they probably lost a lot of money. I don't know how much, but I'd be amazed if the church commissioners didn't take a mighty hit. So that slightly inhibits you when you want to take a position on financial markets. It's like taking a position on casinos when you've spent the night at Monte Carlo. I think the second reason is that the credit crunch or financial crisis or Great Recession or whatever we're going to call it was a very complex historical phenomenon and hard for most people to understand. It was an act of embarrassing oversimplification to say that it was all due to the greed of bankers. And I think anybody who let those words pass his or her lips has some reason to feel embarrassed now. If greedy bankers caused financial crises, there would always be a financial crisis, because greed is to bankers what physical fitness is to footballers. You kind of got to have it. So understanding the crisis was hard. And I don't think many clergymen were well qualified to explain to the congregation on Sunday what was going on. And I think bankers have to rediscover that sense of moral constraint, without which financial markets are in fact worse than casinos. Because at least in a casino, you can calculate the odds. Even if you're a naive gambler, you have some sense of what the fruit machine is going to do. Financial markets without morality are far more dangerous than casinos. And that's, I think, the message that the church failed to convey.
The Root of All Evil was presented by Giles Fraser and produced by Jane Greenwood. It was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Popular uprisings from Cairo to Damascus shook the West's long-standing foreign policy. In a moment, in analysis, Edward Sturton asks the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, what the West will do next. First, Jonathan Friedland takes the long view.
In the new series of The Long View, we'll be looking, as always, at the past behind the present. As the space shuttle is wound up, we'll tell the story of HMS Challenger, an attempt by the superpower of the day to boldly go where no man had gone before, eventually mothballed for costing too much money. And as the BBC plots its move to Salford, we'll look at how the media covers the nation, remembering when the Manchester Guardian moved to London. But we begin with super injunctions, 19th century style. That's the new series of The Long View, starting tomorrow morning at 9. And